Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict speaks about the importance of prayer and points to the examples given by two saints and martyrs who both perished at Auschwitz. Suffering Civilians. A Caritas official in Georgia gives us an insight into the humanitarian emergency created by this week's conflict with Russia over the disputed South Ossetia region. Sri Lanka revisited. 3.5 years after the tsunami struck the island, we find out how well the reconstruction program is proceeding there. And sex slaves. One of the world's best-known campaigners against forced prostitution tells us more about the grim reality of working as a sex slave in modern-day Italy. At his Wednesday general audience, Pope Benedict spoke about the importance of prayer and pointed to the example given by two saints and martyrs who both perished at the Auschwitz death camp. Lydia O'Kane reports.
Pope Benedict on Wednesday held his first weekly audience since his return from the northern Italian town of Bressanone. Speaking from the courtyard of the papal summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, where he is currently residing, he told the pilgrims gathered that during his time in Bressanone, he was able to spend a period of rest. But he added that even in these days of serene relaxation, he prayed to the Lord for all those who had entrusted their prayers to him. Many people, the Pope said, wrote to him expressing their joys and hopes, but also their worries and problems. The Holy Father assured all these people that he remembered them in the celebration of daily Mass and through the Rosary. Whoever prays, Pope Benedict said, does not ever lose hope, even in the most desperate situations. And he went on to describe prominent figures in history, such as Holy Teresa of the Cross or Edith Stein, whose feast was celebrated on the 9th of August, and Maximilian Kolbe, who was remembered on the 14th of August. Both of these saints' lives, said Pope Benedict, ended with martyrdom in the death camp of Auschwitz.
Entrambi hanno concluso con il martirio la loro vicenda terrena nel lager di Auschwitz.
Apparently their existence, the Holy Father continued, could be seen as defeat, but actually in their martyrdom there shines the brilliance of the love that wins over darkness, of selfishness and of hatred. Days before her dramatic end, recalled the Pope, Edith Stein said, I am ready for everything. Jesus is here in the midst of us all. And for Maximilian Kolbe, the last appeal on his lips while he offered his arm to the man who was about to fatally inject it was, Ave Maria. At the end of his address, the Holy Father welcomed all those gathered who had come from near and far to be at the weekly audience.
I am happy to welcome the young Irish pilgrims from Kildare and Leveland who are with us this morning. My warm greeting also goes to the Heise Youth Group from Japan. Upon all things speaking pilgrims, including those from Guam, Canada, and the United States, I call in what God's blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Lydia O'Kane.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy has agreed an outline peace plan with Russia and Georgia to try to resolve the two countries' conflict over the disputed region of South Ossetia. The guns may have fallen silent, but the fallout from the fierce fighting between Georgia and Russia over the past 5 days may take longer to subside. The conflict has created huge tensions in international relations and led many to fear a return to the hostilities of the Cold War era between Russia and the West. In the meantime, it's the civilians who are bearing the brunt of the suffering, with an estimated 100,000 people displaced by the brief conflict. Leon Mehedze is an official for Caritas Georgia, and she tells us more about the humanitarian emergency spawned by the fighting over the past week.
These people are refugees from South Ossetian villages, Georgian villages, and from town Gori, which is very, very heavily bombed by Russian aviation. For sure, we know that we will launch this soup kitchen because these people need. We have already distributed tuna fish, what was in our stock, 1,940 cans, and canned meat, and our bakery baked 500 loaves of bread. Today we are not feeding them because we have no other stock for this, but tomorrow we launch full service of soup kitchen where these people actually will work as volunteers themselves to help our personnel.
Liana, one question. Can you describe for us the refugees, the people who are coming to Georgia from South Ossetia and Gori? What type of people are they? I mean, are they men, women, children? What age group?
In major part, they are women with children.
What do these refugees tell you? What is the psychological state of the people in Georgia?
They are very, very frightened. But this is not the first time, you know. 15 years ago, we had 100,000 IDPs from Abkhazia, ethnically Georgian, cleansed from that place, 300,000 people. And 11,000 were ethnic Georgians who lived in that Ossetian places of South Ossetia. So this is not new for Georgians, but this is more scaring for them. We think that we will provide also some psychological support of these people alongside with the soup kitchen, with the simple feeding.
That was Liana Mukhedze from Caritas, Georgia, talking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. It's 3.5 years since the tsunami struck Sri Lanka in the morning hours of December the 26, 2004. The giant waves that swept ashore along much of the island's coastline left over 36,000 people dead and displaced more than 500,000 people and affected the lives of 500,000 more. In the initial weeks following the tsunami, when Sri Lanka and other affected nations in Asia were bathed in the spotlight of the world's media with dramatic images of the death and destruction wrought by the waves, until other global news stories and natural disasters came along to grab the headlines. So since the attention of the world has moved on to other trouble spots, how has the reconstruction effort in Sri Lanka proceeded since then? And are the people there managing to rebuild their shattered lives? And is the resurgence of fighting between Sri Lankan government troops and separatist Tamil Tiger rebels impacting upon the situation? One person who saw with his own eyes the striking contrast between the scenes of utter devastation in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami and the current state of the reconstruction program in Sri Lanka is writer and photographer David Snyder, who carries out freelance projects for Catholic Relief Services and Caritas Internationalis. He recently returned to the island for the first time since his assignment there in the days following the tsunami and told me how things have changed in the intervening 3.5 years.
Sure. Well, the difference, you know, obviously is night and day from what it was when I was there just after the tsunami struck. You know, obviously, we all remember, you know, those images on television. The scale of that devastation was just incredible. So, having been there then and seen that, it was interesting to get the chance to go back now, years later, and see the reconstruction effort from roads to public buildings to private houses. Really, the construction, the reconstruction efforts have been just so widespread and so far-reaching. They've had just a tremendous impact there.
And what kind of contribution has the Catholic Church or organizations like Caritas and Catholic Relief Services played in this reconstruction effort?
Right, they've really been just fundamental to the reconstruction effort. Caritas, Catholic Relief Services, other groups as well, really stepped in literally from the hours after the tsunami struck to initially provide the kind of short-term emergency relief. I mean, obviously, in the days and weeks after, people needed food, they needed temporary shelter, they needed water, they needed the basic essentials. And then, you know, after that process kind of played out over weeks and months, you know, people started really turning their attention to the long-term reconstruction. And that's where CRS and Caritas really kind of excelled. I mean, I think so far they've built about 7,500 homes. And you figure on average family size there is about five or six people. So they've reached, you know, certainly tens of thousands of people with permanent, well-built, long-term shelter. So they've really been fundamental to the reconstruction effort there.
Are there still some outstanding problems, some people who are still not got a proper roof over their heads?
There are still a few. I mean, by and large now, you know, 3 years since the tsunami, the vast, vast majority of those who lost their homes are now, you know, resettled or are living in homes that have been rebuilt. There are a few thousand, people give you different figures. I've heard as many as 15,000, 10 to 15,000 who still don't have proper long-term homes. And there are various reasons for that. Some are still in debate about where they should be resettled. Maybe they were living too close to the coast. The government wants them to move back a little bit from the coast, and they're still trying to find areas to accommodate that.
When it comes to anecdotes, are there any heartwarming or poignant stories of people who have managed to rebuild their lives afterwards despite amazing odds?
I mean, for me, again, having flashing back to kind of when I was there afterwards, I mean, it's one of the things I remember most about my days in Sri Lanka immediately after the tsunami was just literally everyone you met who was alive had a story about being alive. That's literally the scale of this disaster. Every person you met had an amazing story about why they were alive. They climbed a tree. You know, their house was the only one in the entire neighborhood that survived the tsunami, and these kinds of stories. And so when I went back this time, you know, certainly I went with that in mind, and I spoke maybe not specifically anecdotally with individuals, but I remember, you know, having that in mind when I talked to so many of them. And, you know, I met one family who, in fact, it was a house that Caritas had rebuilt, and I spent a couple hours with that family, and they now had about a 3.5-year-old child with them. He was the grandson of the woman, the beneficiary, and the whole family had been away inland that day to have the child christened the day that the tsunami hit. So they left their house, went inland, you know, a couple miles to have to a church to have the child christened. It was a Sunday, and then they came back, and their house had been destroyed, but the entire family, all the relatives, had been inland when the child was christened, and so now they kind of look to this child as a miracle child of sorts, because they've, you know, they survived the tsunami essentially because that child drew them away that day.
Now, of course, in Sri Lanka, there's a civil war that's been raging since 1983 between the government troops and the Tamil Tiger or LTTT rebels. What about the plight of the displaced people on the island as a result of this conflict? This is a rather overlooked problem, isn't it?
It is indeed. I really think the world kind of doesn't know much at all about that conflict in Sri Lanka. And even I, who had been there before, had to kind of read up a little bit on it just to get a kind of a better understanding of the roots and history of the conflict. It's one of the things, especially in the areas of Batticaloa out in the east, where a lot of people lost homes. It was a major scene of some of the major disaster area following the tsunami. And a lot of people who lost their homes to the tsunami have also been caught up in the fighting that's been happening since. There was a big resurgence in fighting in late 2006 and into early 2007. And since April 2007, 180,000 people were displaced by this fighting. So it is still an ongoing conflict. And as the government has been recently engaging these Tamil Tiger troops and forced them from the east, from the areas around Batticaloa, and pushed them back up into smaller areas in the north of the country, and has kind of left in its wake this population of displaced people, a few of whom were still living in camps when I was there.
I was talking there to David Snyder, writer and photographer, who recently returned from Sri Lanka. Prostitutes lining the roads are a common sight in many parts of Rome and its surroundings. And it's a scene that is repeated throughout the country, especially in the richer northern cities.
Outreach groups believe that Italy has around 25,000 street prostitutes. But how often do we ever stop to think about the circumstances that led these women or girls to take up the world's oldest profession? Most of us may be inclined simply to see them as mere prostitutes, but nowadays a more apt description for the majority of them would be sex slaves. Italian sister Eugenia Bonetti has been named by the US State Department as one of the heroes acting to end modern-day slavery for her work in sheltering and rehabilitating women rescued from forced prostitution. According to Sister Eugenia, most of the women working on the streets of Italy are recruited back in their home countries and come here under the pretext of a job. Many are from Nigeria or Eastern Europe, especially Romania. After being tricked in this way, their documents are taken away and they are forced to sell their bodies for money. Sister Eugenia spoke to me about the grim reality of working as a sex slave in modern-day Italy.
We no more speak about prostitution when we deal with these women, because we are very much aware that these women have not chosen to become prostitutes, but they have chosen to come to Europe, to Italy, in order to help their families to better their lives and the lives of the members of the families. Because the majority of the women we see on the streets are there because they are forced to be there. This is the difference between being a prostitute because you want to do that, or to be forced to be a prostitute because you have been sold and bought by criminal organization because they want money from these women.
Where do these women mostly come from, and what sort of age are they?
The two biggest groups that we are dealing with, they are Nigerians and Romanians nowadays. There is a difference between the Nigerians and Romanians. Romanians are very young. The majority nowadays we can meet on the streets that are Romanians are below the age of 18.
How young do they get?
They can be even 15, 16, 17 years. They are very young, though they don't say that they are minors. Instead, for the girls from Nigeria, the age is a bit higher. So you can have 19, 20, 21, 22. But there is a difference nowadays with Nigerian women. The ones we are receiving now, they are not educated. So they are coming really from the bush.
And so how are these women being tricked into coming? Is it a case of somebody coming along who's working for the traffickers, who tells them that he can get them a good job in a city or in the West? How does it happen?
Of course, now the recruitment is done normally in places of origin. And this is done either by women or relatives to the women who are the traffickers, or it is done by some men that offer some help when the girls have no option, no opportunities, because they simply say, now, we have a sister, we have a friend, we know somebody that is looking for somebody that can work in their restaurant, in their factories, in their shops, and so they need somebody to help them. Of course, they have no money, they have no documents, but they say, don't worry, we are going to take care of all these kind of things. You should not worry. Once you are in Italy, you will give us back the money we spent for you. So they present themselves as really people who would like to help.
And is that the same in Eastern Europe as well? Is it a similar sort of situation, or are there differences there?
Now, in Eastern Europe, the situation is very different, because in Eastern Europe, we have young boys that lure these girls on a pretense of falling in love with them. The majority, they have a young boy that says, now we go to Europe, now we get married, we work, and when they are in Europe, the girl goes to work on the street and the man eats all the money. For Nigerians, normally we have women exploiting women, which is terrible. The young girls from the East are controlled at the site on the street. Instead, for the Nigerian girls, they are not controlled by anybody, because they are controlled by the voodoo,
the black magic.
The black magic they have to perform before coming to Italy. And so there is no need for the madams to follow them and to know where they are and what they do. Because this psychological violence, this black magic is performing on these young girls, especially if they are uneducated, it is more than enough to control them and to make them believe that if they run away, if they report the case to the police, the bad spirit is going to hold on them, is going to destroy them, to destroy their families. And we have many, many cases of girls who are mentally sick because of this black magic.
Now, once these girls, by whatever means, they end up in the hands of the pimps in Italy, and they find themselves being tricked into working on the streets, how badly are they treated? Apart from the voodoo, do they sometimes use physical violence to force some of these girls, particularly the girls, say, from Eastern Europe?
For everybody, you know, life on the street is always a great risk, and you have to put into account really mistreatment, not only on the side of pimps or madams, but also on the side of clients, maniacs, so they are always at risk. But the majority that it's done by the pimps and the madams is when the girls are not going back home with money. Maybe sometimes they are not having enough money, so when they go back, they are beaten. They are beaten thoroughly in order to make them work more and to make sure that when they go back at the end of their night time or day time, they can bring 200, 300, 400 euro. Otherwise, they are really very, very much mistreated.
This money, do they have to hand it all over?
All the money, it has to be handed over to the traffickers or to the madame. This is the case in a special way nowadays for Nigerians. Until they have finished to pay their debt, a Nigerian, to be free again, she has to produce more than 70, 80,000 euro.
So how many of them do ever get free? Because that's a huge amount of money.
This is a huge amount of money that for a young girl that has to pay this money, she has to undergo not less than 4,000 sexual encounters. And when she has finished to pay this money, she's also finished in all aspects. Physically, emotionally, psychologically, socially, and that is why this kind of experience is having a very, very bad effect on the life of the dignity of these young girls, because they lose all sense of who they are.
When it comes to the East Europeans who are not, shall we say, the victims of these voodoo, how often do they pluck up the courage or manage to escape from their traffickers?
They have the courage to escape because, especially at the beginning, they were really also mistreated terribly by their pimps. Nowadays, it is a bit more difficult because the pimps have understood that just mistreating them, they were not going very far. So they use a new system. That's why this is a phenomenon that is always on the change. Nowadays, they make a kind of a contract with them, saying, now, if you work for me, I protect you on the streets. I'll give you accommodation, I'll give you everything you need. At the end of the month, I give you a salary, but all the rest of the money will be with me. So they are doing this kind of a trick in order to make the girls not to run away, because they can always say she has agreed, and at the end of the month, I give a salary. Or they do in another way, they pay on a percentage. If you get 100 euro, now you keep 10% and they get 90%. So these kind of things nowadays is becoming very common, and it is becoming more difficult for the girls to have the courage to run away. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done in contacting the girls. That's why we meet them on the streets. We talk to them. We offer them opportunities. We tell them we are willing and ready to protect you, to protect your families, so that you can live a life worth of being lived as women.
But presumably it takes time to build up their trust. It's not often that they would come with you the first time. Presumably
of
you
course,
have to carry on this.
That's why every week we meet these young people on the streets. We meet, we establish a relationship, we know them, we know their stories, their suffering. We are ready to help them because we have shelters where we can welcome them, we can offer them the opportunity of rebuild again their life, whatever they have been stolen, their dignity, their identity, their youth, their health, because some of them get also very sick. Some of them become pregnant, and so they are forced to go for abortions. We have, for instance, young girls from Eastern Europe that you can count between 3, 4, 5 abortions each, and at the end they are all broken, they are all destroyed. Since 1998, when the Italian government gave the opportunity to these young girls who had the courage to leave the street and also some of them to denounce their traffickers, we were able to give them a new status.
How many people are we talking about?
We are talking about more than 5,000 young girls who have been able to receive this benefit of a permit to stay and to work in Italy, to be able to start a different life because they have gone through this rehabilitation, reintegration, getting to know the language, getting to know a job, in order to be able to work and to become normal human beings again.
Let's talk a little bit about the clients. Presumably there's no lack of clients for these women who work on the streets, is that right?
Yes, we would not have such a big number of young women, because this is the point. This is a very sad point that unfortunately nobody wants to talk about it. When we speak about this forced prostitution, slavery, trafficking in human beings, we are always focusing our attention on women, especially young women, minors, and it is very seldom that we have the courage to speak about the demand, the consumers. That's why there is a great fight. We really have to fight against this corruption, this organization, and also we have to inform the mentality of our young people to start with, so that they can understand that a body of a young girl cannot be bought. Because they simply said, but I pay, so now she does what I want because I give her payment.
So these men, they come from all walks of life. How often are they married?
Now these men, 70% of them have wives, children, or they live with somebody, and that is very sad. When we see cars on the street stopping, picking up these young girls, and at times we can see that there is a sign on the car saying baby on board or a babysitter.
Finally, any particular remark made by any of these girls that you've rescued or rehabilitated that really sums up either what they've been through or how they've recovered?
One of the greatest remarks, and the many of the remarks we receive from the girls, it is this: you have saved my life. I was destroyed. I was a dead body walking around, because how many times I wanted to get rid of my life because of the humiliation. It is wonderful to see how really working together we can achieve a great deal, and we can give hope for these young people that it is not the end, but it can be the beginning.
I was speaking there to Italian sister Eugenio Bonetti, a campaigner against forced prostitution. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.